Kellogg, Idaho is really more of a car dealership than it is a town. Its population is 2,255. Dave Smith Motors, the local dealership, employs about 400. On any given day, more cars may sit on its lot than there are people who live in Kellogg. And make no mistake, these are not secondhand 30-year-old beaters, left to rust in the middle of nowhere, Idaho. No, these are brand new $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 Ford Super Duties, in a place where the median household income is $35,000 a year, 30% less than Mississippi. Neither is Kellogg really near anything. Just 12,000 people live within a 20-mile radius. The closest major airport is in Spokane, Washington, over an hour's drive away. And yet, this tiny, rural, and remote pit stop on I-90 is home to the nation's largest Jeep Ram dealer. It's quite surreal. As you drive through Kellogg, which takes all of about 2.5 minutes, you'll see a diner, a post office, and a hardware store. The things you'd expect in a town of 2,000 people. This shack doubles as its city hall, police station, and zoning department. This, by the way, is its mayor, now 81 years old. Then, out of nowhere, you'll find yourself surrounded by row after row of pristine Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, Chevy, and GMC trucks. Now, Kellogg may be an extreme example, for reasons we'll soon get into. But all across America are small towns like this one, overshadowed by giant dealerships. Their owners are often the richest people around. When we imagine the ultra-wealthy, we think of celebrities, venture capitalists, and politicians. In reality, America's 0.1% are hiding in plain sight. They own law firms, doctor's offices, and car dealerships. Last year, the average Toyota dealer in the Boston area made a $6 million profit, and an estimated 20% of all owners make at least $1.5 million a year. So why is buying and reselling a commodity, cars, as lucrative as becoming an accomplished doctor or lawyer? Because of something called dealer franchise laws. Whereas Apple, Sony, and Samsung can open their own stores, Ford, Toyota, and Honda cannot. By law, cars must be sold by middlemen, who often have exclusivity over their region. It wasn't always this way. In 1949, the US population was just 45% of what it is today. Yet, there were three times as many car dealerships, nearly 50,000 in total. Dealers at the time were scattered throughout the country. They were small, mom-and-pop operations that served only their local communities. Car makers, on the other hand, were far more consolidated than they are today. Before the rise of foreign brands, there were just the big three: Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. This created an extreme imbalance of power. Since dealers depended on these powerful corporations for inventory, the latter effectively wielded total control. Car makers could offload risk onto dealers by forcing them to buy unpopular models. So, although cars were initially sold many different ways, in factory stores, by mail order, and even by traveling salesmen, all 50 states eventually stepped in to protect dealers. By, for example, making it illegal to force them to buy cars they didn't want. And car makers could no longer undercut their prices by selling directly to consumers. But they didn't stop there. These laws went further, shifting nearly all the risk back onto the manufacturer. Apple, of course, can at any time simply stop supplying Best Buy with iPhones. But in many states, car makers can only terminate their franchise agreement for specific reasons, like fraud. Otherwise, they must compensate the dealer, for example, the value of all future profits, future rent, and unsold inventory. If dealers previously shouldered all the risk, now they assumed zero. State law virtually guaranteed their profitability. Needless to say, this made them very, very comfortable, especially as family dealerships were passed down to children who came to expect this special treatment. Then came the internet. Long insulated from competition, dealers were paralyzed. And in what would become a pattern, they argued their very existence was threatened. Thus, they lobbied for even more government protection. In reality, the internet wasn't a threat to the industry. It was only a threat to lazy, uncompetitive dealers. Like any shift in the market, it simply created new winners and losers. Only this time, the winners often came from the smallest, most remote parts of the country, like Kellogg, Idaho. When Dave Smith Motors opened its doors in 1965, Idaho was the silver capital of the world. Miners flocked to the region and sustained the local economy. Then, after a brief spike, the price of silver came crashing down in the 1980s, leaving thousands unemployed. Unlike most dealerships, therefore, which had grown complacent, Dave Smith was forced to adapt. The local population had collapsed. For these small-town dealers, the internet presented an opportunity, not a threat. Thanks to Idaho's cheap land and labor, Dave Smith could beat larger dealers on price. Customers would shop online and then fly from as far away as Alaska or Florida. When they landed in Spokane, a Dave Smith shuttle bus drove them an hour east to Kellogg. These tiny regional dealers slowly grew into unstoppable corporate behemoths, merging and swallowing up hundreds of competitors. Dave Smith, for instance, is today part of Sonic Automotive, the nation's fifth largest dealer. Or take the number one auto group in the nation, Lithia Motors. Last year, Lithia sold 679,000 cars, 1,800 per day. In 2020, it acquired a new dealership every 5 days. And in the 2 years between 2020 and 2022, the company doubled its annual revenue. Yet, it all started in Little Ashland, Oregon, a quiet town of about 6,000 people at the time. Now, even 100 years ago, dealer franchise laws were peculiar. Here was the government essentially negotiating contracts on behalf of dealers. Like laws in New Jersey and Oregon making it illegal for drivers to pump their own gas, these restrictions were more than a little silly, arbitrary, and inefficient. Still, the intentions were defensible. These laws kept the lights on for countless small-town family dealerships. And besides, it was hard to muster much sympathy for giants like Toyota. But today, the balance of power has unmistakably shifted. Last year, Lithia Motors made $30 billion, more than the worldwide revenue of Subaru or Mazda, and not far behind Volvo. The average dealership now generates $71 million in sales each year. And the average price of a new car increased by 40% between 2015 and 2022, driven largely by dealer markups. In other words, the days of mom-and-pop dealerships are well and truly over. So why do the laws of all 50 states continue to favor Lithia, a $30 billion corporation, over Subaru, a $28 billion corporation? Here's a hint. Virtually every state legislator has a dealership in their district. Dealers sponsor Little League teams, donate to Meals on Wheels, and keep local newspapers alive through advertising. In Nevada and Arizona, the average dealer employs almost 100 people. Car sales account for about 20% of all state sales taxes. And the National Dealers Association is one of the most powerful lobbying groups. In short, dealers are a strong and united political force to be reckoned with. Then came electric vehicles. When Tesla entered the market in 2013, it decided not to sell through dealers, who it argued were biased against EVs. Dealers, unsurprisingly, make the vast majority of their revenue from sales. Thus, you might argue they have no reason to sell one make or model over another. In terms of profit, however, dealers are mechanics who also sell cars on the side. Historically, most make more from parts and service than sales. And since electric vehicles require less service, they generate about 40% less aftermarket revenue. So, when Consumer Reports sent secret shoppers to 85 dealerships asking about EVs, 35 advised them to buy conventional instead. A few even pretended they didn't sell them. Simply put, Tesla couldn't trust them, and that put lawmakers in an awkward position. Previously, they could argue that dealers needed government protection to survive. But Tesla didn't have a relationship with dealers to protect in the first place. Thus, they could provide no clear reason why it shouldn't be allowed to sell directly to consumers. Every state has responded differently. In Michigan, Tesla can market its cars by opening showrooms and offering test drives, so long as the actual sale technically occurs out of state. In Texas, its cars must first be exported out of state and then re-imported to a local buyer. Tesla salespeople can't legally mention prices or even direct buyers to the company's website. In Connecticut, Tesla drivers can lease but not buy. And in New Mexico, the company opened dealerships on tribal land, where most state laws don't apply. Other states make special exceptions for Tesla. It can open, for example, up to 3 dealerships in Ohio. Strange as these laws are, they started drawing attention to the shady practices of dealers. Slowly but surely, momentum is starting to build in the opposite direction. Ford and Volvo recently announced plans to start selling their vehicles online. Slow and arduous price negotiations are going out of style. And Hyundai will soon even sell its cars on Amazon. After nearly a century, the dealer monopoly is finally weakening. Similarly, traditional media companies no longer have a monopoly on great entertainment. Today's creators can bypass yesterday's gatekeepers and control our own distribution, which is why we started our very own streaming platform, Nebula, home to my original series, China Actually. If you're only watching these videos here on YouTube, you're missing out on some of the best of Polymatter. Like my new Nebula exclusive about China's one-child policy, how it was paradoxically both incredibly cruel and also surprisingly ineffective. Plus, why the party kept it on the books for so long, even as Chinese academics were calling for its removal. Nebula is also home to other great originals like Wendover Productions' Logistics of X, which goes deep on topics like search and rescue, ski resorts, and commercial fishing. And Relife Lore's Modern Conflicts, mini-documentaries on some of the world's most brutal and consequential recent wars. There are no ads, and many videos are available early. Now, Nebula has never taken VC funding. Instead, we rely on the support of viewers like you. Which is why, rather than raise prices like many streaming services, we're running a limited-time promotion. You can get unrestricted lifetime access to Nebula by making a one-time payment of $300 today. Or, if you prefer, an annual subscription for just $2.50 a month. That's 50% off the usual price by clicking the link on screen now or in the description.